Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Outlook 2021 for MBS and securitized products. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy for Amherst Pierpont. The last year has probably packed enough surprises for a few lifetimes, but get ready for more in 2021. A pandemic has definitely changed the economy, true in the U.S. and around the world. The Fed and central bank activity has changed markets, again, true in the U.S. and around the world, and arguably for the first time since the 2008 financial crisis, government has jumped into the mix, and fiscal policies have had just tremendous impact. Today, we want to spend the next 30 minutes or so talking about the aftershocks of these things. And we're going to do it in a couple of sections. In markets, I'll spend a few minutes outlining five major investment themes likely to drive markets and returns next year. In the economy, Stephen Stanley will point to ways the economy could confound consensus. In agency MBS, Brian Landy will make the case that prepayments have peaked and that servicers will be important next year. In non-agency MBS, Chris Helwig will look at an uneven recovery in mortgage credit. And in CMBS, Mary Beth Fisher will highlight some key prepayment and credit trends there. You'll notice you have a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen. You can use that to ask questions during any point in the presentations, but we'll save them until we finish the initial outlooks, and then we'll open the call to Q&A and start taking your questions. So why don't we jump right in and focus on five things to know for 2021, things that could help you get ahead of the basic rates of returns in markets. First, the yield curve really looks very likely to steepen far faster and far more than forward rates imply. If you look at the forward rates and at the slope of the yield curve over the next year, it really barely changes. The spread between 2-year and 10-year yields today is about 76 basis points. A year from now, the market prices in a slope only slightly higher, around 85. But there are two things likely to make that slope much larger, and by much larger meaning at least a slope of 100 basis points and possibly 125 basis points or more. On the short end, the Fed and its new policy of flexible average inflation targeting is likely to hold the front end of the curve down far longer than traditional histories might indicate. The Fed dots puts the Fed on hold through 2023, and even though Fed funds and OIS lately have raised expectations that the Fed will potentially lift off late in that time frame, I would stick with the dots and bet against OIS for now. That should keep the short end low. On the long end, pandemic recovery, Fed accommodation, a possible series of fiscal stimulus, not just in response to pandemic, but in other areas as well, looks very likely to drive longer rates higher. We've already seen implied inflation rise just in the last few weeks from the 170s to the 190s, and that should continue over the course of the coming year. The trades for that would involve steepeners in almost any place you could find them, in rates, in MBS by going overweight pass-throughs or CMOs with short rather than long key rate durations. That is another way of saying going up in coupon, or in the ultimate curve steepening trade, which would be in inverse IO. The second area we expect the market to get surprised is that lower rated credits, both corporate and in structured product, should outperform higher rated credits. Again, the Fed and the economy are likely to drive this outcome. On the Fed side, it really is all about QE. QE absorbs the safe assets in the market and squeezes investors into a tier or two or three higher in risk. And we've watched that happen all year long. So QE on its own would favor these weaker credits. But in addition to that, we're likely to get a rebound from pandemic, and lower rated credits are much more levered to the economy than higher rated credits. In fact, the lower the credit, the greater the impact of small changes in growth and income. There's a little bit of risk in this as we roll out vaccines. There could be logistical issues. There could be slow uptake. But we're very, very likely to have significant renormalization by the end of 2021. So the trades for this is to prefer high yield positions, corporate or structure, over IG positions. So high yield should outperform IG. IG should outperform the safest plain vanilla agency MBS, and MBS should outperform rates. A third area where we see major opportunity is in private debt, and private debt should deliver especially strong returns. The reason for this and the reason for the timing is in the traditional practice of banks to basically tighten lending in bad times and to loosen lending in good times. And we saw that. We saw that in 2020 with the senior loan officer's opinion survey showing that underwriting essentially across all forms of bank credit tightened substantially, just as it did after the crisis of 2008, and even as it did going back to the crisis of 2001, the bursting of the internet bubble. That has left a lot of good, creditworthy borrowers out in the cold, and they are now getting loans and will get loans in 2021 from private lenders, and those loans should be better than average. The opportunities for investors, if they're not going to lend privately, would be to finance positions in private lending. That could occur through CLOs, that could occur through middle market CLOs, that could occur through private financings of a wider variety of debt, including corporate loans, commercial real estate, single-family rentals, and things of that sort. A fourth area, best-in-class niche platforms and the debt issued by those platforms. Again, a good investment opportunity this year. This has everything to do with the benefits and advantages of size and especially the advantages of an investment-grade rating. Investment-grade spreads have not only recovered from where they widened during COVID, but they are actually tight to pre-COVID levels, while non-investment grade spreads have lagged significantly. And a part of that is the backing that the Fed was willing to provide to investment grade issuers. That's given them a significant capital advantage, and the bigger, stronger issuers are likely to go on an acquisition campaign in 2021. The players that you want to own are not necessarily the acquirers, but the acquired, where their operations will suddenly be absorbed in a much stronger and much more efficiently financed organization, and you'll see the impact on their debt spreads. And finally, returns to informationally intensive assets should run especially well above average. Pandemic has really broken down a lot of the standard informal methods of communicating and spreading information. And although there's lots of information available in databases, it's the informal process, informal knowledge, knowledge of trust, of preference, of various biases that make information more difficult to get in the general course of business. So investors and portfolios that are able to efficiently handle complex or leveraged structured products, deep credit, again, private transactions, anything that requires good, robust collection and analysis of data, the effort's likely to pay especially well this year. So a quick recap of five themes in the marketplace. And at this point, let's move on to the economy, where there's some surprises that Stephen Stanley will outline.
Thanks, Steve, and good afternoon, everyone. So these year-ahead outlooks for the economy, typically the consensus forecast is relatively boring, and that is, I would say, the case in 2021, despite all of the curveballs that have been thrown at the economy in 2020. If you look, for example, at the most recent Bloomberg monthly survey of economists, GDP forecast for next year by quarter, 3.1, 3.3, 3.2, and 3.2. So very steady growth at what I would call, given the context, a modestly above trend rate. And along with that, the unemployment rate falls very gradually, a few tenths a quarter, from where it is now to a little below 6% by the end of the year. And inflation is expected to run consistently below the Fed's 2% target. There will be a little blip in the year-over-year numbers next spring when the declines that occurred during the lockdowns roll out. But once all that smooths out, the consensus forecast looks for inflation, both headline and core, to settle in a range around 1.75% in the second half of 2021. So that's the consensus against which I'm benchmarking my expectations. And with that in mind, I have three potential surprises in the economy in 2021. The first one is I can see a near complete COVID recovery. So again, you know, looking at that consensus forecast, the expectation is that we're going to get this slow, gradual, and steady climb out of the hole that was created in 2020. And my sense is most economists do not expect the economy to be anywhere close to back to normal by the end of 2021. Certainly the consensus forecasts do not get you back to that point. But in my view, the medical news has been very good recently. The prospect of successful vaccines being broadly distributed in 2021. Some of the treatments that are coming on stream should help as well. And as a result, I think there's a decent chance that the virus is pretty well tamped down, you know, by call it the middle of the year, and then in the second half of the year, things are able to improve substantially. And so you could see what I would say is a more nonlinear recovery, where you get a pop in activity once the sectors of the economy that are right now shut down partially or in some cases almost entirely get back on stream. So restaurants, retailers, hair and nail salons, air travel, spectator events, and some of the more beaten down sectors could see a sharp revival at some point in the next year, not to mention the education sector, where I think there's a good prospect that schools will be fully reopened come next fall. The second surprise is kind of similar to that, but more specific to the labor market. And again, when you look at where the consensus is, the idea is that you are slowly digging your way out of the hole that was created in 2020, but you're still looking at an unemployment rate approaching 6% by the end of next year. So the labor market is nowhere near back to what we would think of as normal, much less to the very robust pre-pandemic state of the world early in 2020. And again, I think that there's a chance that we get a much different outcome for the labor market. I think there's a chance that the unemployment rate falls to something approaching what the Fed would consider to be full employment by the end of next year. And I would say, again, one thing to look out for is it feels like there's a point in time during the year, and it could be the summer or early fall, when you get a nonlinear jump in employment as, you know, again, restaurants and amusement parks and spectator events and hotels and airlines are able to bring back the workers that have been furloughed because of all the closures. You've also got, again, the return of what I hope will be full-on in-person classes in school in the fall, you know, beginning with the new school year in September, which could also add, you know, better than a million workers to the payroll numbers within a couple of months. So I think, you know, that could put the economy in a very different situation than where we were or even where we are now or where the consensus thinks we will be. And then the final potential surprise is on inflation. And here, I think, you know, for me, the big surprise is simply that there's a lot of uncertainty. The Fed seems very confident that inflation is going to remain soft and probably below their target for several more years. And their main rationale is that the unemployment rate is likely to remain elevated. And of course, I would, you know, to some degree, maybe question that assumption. But I think even if you assume that that force is in play and is helping to push down on inflation, there are a number of other forces that may be pushing on the other side. The unwind of social distancing is certainly going to produce a one-time at least pop in prices for a lot of the beaten down sectors, whether it be airfares or hotel rates, auto insurance, college tuition, just to name a few. And on top of that, you've got all the challenges presented by the pandemic that have forced companies to change the way they do business, spending more on cleaning, reallocating their factory floor space, for example, and then the potential higher labor costs that have come along with that, which could force firms to raise their prices to recoup all of those expenses. And then finally, you may see higher energy costs. Obviously, oil prices were quite depressed early on in 2020 because of the lockdowns. And to the extent that that demand for energy starts to normalize and we see higher prices, that could make its way, you know, not only into the headline inflation numbers, but the second round effects into the core. So I don't have a high degree of conviction that inflation is going to be accelerating tremendously in 2021, but I do think there's a lot more uncertainty. I would be kind of hanging loose and prepared for surprises in either direction on the inflation front. And that's it for me.
Okay, thanks very much, Stephen. So in the agency MBS market, this year was a huge surprise in prepayments. Obviously, rates hit historic lows, but even accounting for rates, prepayment speeds turned out to be far different than a lot of models predicted, and there could be some surprises in prepayments again in 2021, and Brian Landy has some views on that. Brian?
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, so to start with, I do think that overall next year should be a kinder one for MBS investors. I think prepayment speeds are likely near or even at their peak. And the reason is that the primary-secondary spread has almost returned back to normal levels, and lenders have a little room left to lower mortgage rates in order to generate new refinance business. Now, so speed should begin to slow as burnout kicks in, which will limit some of the risk in a wide range of 30-year MBS. You know, for example, you know, some of the fastest prepaying collateral, like high coupon pools and jumbo pools, could benefit the most. Somewhat seasoned pools that are kind of past the peak refi window and have seen a large portion of their loans prepay this year are prime candidates to exhibit burnout. Now, here's why I think the primary-secondary spread doesn't have much room left to tighten. Superficially, it may look like it still is a bit wide, but you know, the first factor is the GSE's new 50 basis point adverse market refinance fee that kicked in this month increases the cost of most refinance transactions, and that will raise the floor for the primary-secondary spread, say, by about 10 to 15 basis points over the historical norm. But in addition to that, the average borrower has been getting a lower rate on their loan than what's indicated by estimates of mortgage rates. I actually have a graph on the slide that shows that. I looked over the prior 6 years, and there's a pretty stable relationship between the average rate given to a borrower and the Freddie Mac survey rate is what I used here. There's usually about a 20 to 25 basis point difference where the average rate is higher than what the survey rate shows. But since March, and this is where the line dips down into the red, that difference has basically vanished. And that means that primary secondary spreads are really about 20 to 25 basis points tighter than what that survey rate suggests, so comparing, say, the survey rate to the current coupon. And if you take these two factors together, it really leaves about 10 basis points of real tightening that's left that could happen. And you've had the primary secondary spread tightening by about 10 basis points per month throughout the fall. So, I mean, if that pace were to continue, you'd really have you'd reach a low by the end of the year. So, and that I think also is another reason that, you know, models have had had some trouble this year, that, you know, a lot of models are calibrated to rate for, you know, external primary rate surveys like that. And you're feeding in a rate that's, you know, potentially 20 to 25 basis points higher than where your S-curves are calibrated. And, you know, that slows speeds coming out of models. So now, kind of moving on, the although I think overall, you know, speeds, you know, are set to slow down from the peak, that will bring about a slowdown in origination volumes as refinancing drops. And that could actually add or bring prepayment volatility to smaller servicers, which could potentially accelerate speeds on some of those servicers if they've, you know, previously been kind of on the slower side. You know, some ways maybe to avoid that are, you know, buying pools from, you know, maybe larger banks that are, you know, unlikely to be you know, like U.S. Bank, that would be a safer choice, or maybe, you know, even a non-bank servicer like Freedom. And the reason is that it's possible that a lot of these, as these lenders have to deal with the drop in revenue, that could eventually, at first it'll drive job cuts, but then eventually smaller, more inefficient lenders may be unable to compete and will either, you know, have to, say, go out of business or be acquired. And if that servicing is acquired by some of the bigger lenders, if they tend to be, you know, going from a slower prepaying servicer to a faster servicer, you could see some prepayment volatility added and speeds pick up. It sort of had similar consolidation at the end of the or after the 2008 financial crisis. And at that time, it was really with the big banks that grew and a lot of market share kind of flowed into, consolidated into a few different entities. But after that, regulation opened the door to non-bank lending. And this time around, it seems likely that the bigger non-banks would be the acquiring firms. Now, you know, another thing that, you know, might add, you know, to, say, negative convexity in MBS over time is the kind of increasing use of, you know, appraisal waivers and, you know, some of the other, you know, appraisal benefits that that were instituted, you know, throughout COVID-19 or in response to COVID-19. So, like the GSEs, you know, for example, permitted more appraisals that didn't require an interior inspection. You know, purchase loans could be appraised entirely without an on-site inspection, and refinance loans can get an exterior-only appraisal. And, of course, many of these loans qualify for appraisal waivers, which is separate and, you know, kind of in addition to some of those other flexibilities. Now, if all these loans perform similarly, you know, on a credit basis compared to the loans that did get an appraisal, it might be pretty difficult to roll those changes back. And that means that this you know, additional negative convexity may really kind of be baked in the long term, and MBS would be likely to prepay quickly again in any future refinance environment. And finally, I just want to cover a few, you know, other little topics I think that don't really actually seem likely to trigger big changes in mortgage markets. The first is, you know, I think at this point, right at this time, the FHA is unlikely to lower insurance premiums. I mean, they face big payouts to cover insurance claims stemming from COVID-19 forbearance. So payment deferrals, you know, the FHA's partial claim process will draw capital from the FHA's insurance fund, and you're probably more likely to need to focus on rebuilding capital rather than lowering premiums. Similarly, you know, the GSEs just raised guarantee fees with the adverse market refinance fee, so a reduction in LLPAs seems unlikely. And although they've qualified mortgage patch was set to expire in January, allowing that to happen would be certainly very disruptive to markets, since so many borrowers do rely on the patch to get conventional mortgages. So any replacement that, you know, is eventually put in place for the patch would, you know, likely have probably broad coverage. And with that, thank you, and I'll hand it back to Steve.
All right. Thanks very much, Brian. So outside of the agency market, in the parts of the residential market where credit matters, there was lots of concern coming out of March and April about the impact of pandemic on borrowers beyond just consumers in general. And we saw a big rise in forbearance, delinquency, and a wide range of responses from servicers. And now we're starting to look at the other side of that. And that's going to play out in 2021. And Chris Helwig has some thoughts on what that recovery may look like in mortgage credit. Chris?
Thanks, Steve. Afternoon, everybody. So the steady improvement in delinquency trends across the various sectors of mortgage credit is starting to become increasingly disparate. Non-QM, seasoned RPL, and prime cohorts have recovered in a more meaningful way, and prepayments are on the rise. Better collateral performance and an uptick in prepayment rates should only add to the negative convexity of non-QM trusts, and collateral selection will likely be the key driver of outperformance there. A lift in RPL prepayment rates should be constructive for roll-down and deleveraging of those structures, although only certain sectors of the RPL market appear poised to show a continued uptick in prepayment rates. Negative convexity will likely continue to increase in prime collateral, as increased competition amongst lenders should drive non-conforming rates tighter versus conforming ones. Certain sectors of the legacy market appear particularly susceptible to continued elevated delinquency rates and should produce slower prepayments as a result of higher roll rates on previously modified loans. Despite the overall flattening of delinquency rates across most areas of mortgage credit in recent months, there are still some collateral profiles that continue to see improvement, particularly in the non-QM sector, where overall delinquency rates continue to fall and loans with certain attributes are even outperforming the broader trend. Investor loans in particular have exhibited stronger credit performance than owner-occupied loans to date, as delinquency rates are trending roughly 2.5% below those of owner-occupied loans. Falling delinquency rates will increase negative convexity in these deals, as the overall improvement in credit performance in non-QM trusts may serve to not only increase negative convexity by a faster prepayment rate, but also as a result of the potentially growing incentive for sponsors to exercise short-dated call options on these trusts as more loans reperform. With that said, deals backed in part or whole by non-QM investor loans may serve to limit negative convexity from prepayments to some extent. Despite exhibiting better credit performance than owner-occupied loans, non-QM investor loans continue to prepay slower, potentially providing investors looking for short-duration options in mortgage credit a more stable profile than bonds backed by mostly owner-occupied loans. Performance in investor collateral may also be buoyed by the fact that they are commercial-purpose loans and not subject to the qualified mortgage rules, as it seems plausible that there may be less frequent or lighter-touch modifications on these loans, given borrowers cannot bring ability to repay challenges against originators of these loans. And the risk of ATR exposure may provide significant incentive for originators and servicers of low documentation owner-occupied loans to offer more significant loan modifications. Moving to RPLs, to date, post-crisis reperforming loan securitizations have exhibited some of the strongest recovery in terms of borrower performance, and prepayment speeds have risen by roughly 50% versus the slowest speeds observed in June. However, higher roll rates on modified loans may suggest that post-crisis RPLs may be subject to elevated delinquency rates going forward if the recent trends hold. Looking across major RPL shelves, delinquency rates and the trajectory of those rates vary significantly by issuer. Overall, delinquency rates are highest in deals where the collateral is sourced from legacy trusts, where loans have been subject to more frequent and significant loan modifications. Conversely, performance has been better on shelves where the collateral has been sourced from commercial bank and GSE portfolios, where there have in all likelihood been less frequent and lighter touch modifications. Better performance in RPL deals backed by bank or GSE loans may also be driven by stronger payment velocity exhibited by borrowers in those trusts, as those deals generally have higher concentrations of loans with longer current pay strength. In these cases, borrower credit has likely cured somewhat materially, and to that end, it seems less likely that those borrowers would be incentivized to take loan modifications as it would adversely impact their credit. Given the total return associated with deleveraging and rolling down the spread curve, investors should target RPL mezzanine tranches in sequential structures with cleaner collateral pools and premium current pay bonds backed by dirtier pools to benefit from slower speeds. In prime collateral, prepayment speeds are likely to remain elevated for a number of reasons, but one primary driver may be the composition of loans that get securitized, as both pressure on net interest margins and the need to replace runoff of loans and securities at large banks may drive institutions to hold a growing amount of lower WAC core retail jumbo loans on their balance sheet, thereby increasing the negative convexity of loans that ultimately flow to securitization execution. Additionally, jumbo originators whose operations were either temporarily suspended or downsized in the spring appear to have ramped back up, and monetary policies implemented by the Fed in response to the pandemic have created large stores of excess liquidity, creating significant bank demand for loans and securities. Increased competition for loans between bank and non-bank originators may put continued pressure on the spread between conforming and non-conforming rates, which may in turn drive faster speeds on non-conforming loans going forward. Faster speeds should help deleverage structures with prime subordinates potentially poised to outperform absent any material credit weakness. Turning to the legacy market, it appears delinquency rates may continue to remain elevated and prepayments relatively slow in most cohorts. In the case of legacy subprime and option arms, it appears that a substantial amount of previously current pay loans were rolling into early stage delinquency as of November remittance. After accounting for both capitalization modifications and loans being marked as current but being reported as in forbearance, 9.5% of previously current pay loans in the subprime cohort and 7.5% of those loans in the option on cohort fell 30 days past due in the November remittance cycle. These roll rates are substantially elevated relative to most other legacy and post-crisis cohorts, with the exception of the legacy Alt-A cohort, where roll rates are elevated as well. Once again, elevated roll rates in these three legacy cohorts are largely driven by larger populations of previously modified loans that are showing higher roll rates in the wake of the pandemic than loans that had not experienced a prior modification. Comparing roll rates on previously modified loans versus those that had not experienced a modification across all cohorts shows that roll rates on modified loans were roughly 1.75 to 3.25 times those of non-modified loans. Slower prepayments and elevated delinquency rates in certain sectors of the legacy market should benefit IO profiles, specifically IO profiles backed by option arm collateral, particularly deals backed by loans in judicial states with long foreclosure timelines, and as those may provide investors with a fairly attractive source of carry into next year. And that's all I have.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Covered a lot of territory there, so thanks very much. Now let's start thinking about CMBS, especially the multifamily world, where, again, we saw big effects of pandemic with lots of delinquencies, changes in prepayment behavior, and the continued evolution of that over the course of the next year, and Mary Beth Fisher has been watching all of those. Beth, you want to outline that?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. What we're looking at next year is kind of the dichotomy between the two types of prepayments. And on the upside, we're going to have a steeper yield curve, most likely higher rates, and this should materially slow voluntary prepayments in agency CMBS, at least for the next year, probably for the next several years, in some cases for very recent vintage loans, possibly for the lifetime of the loan if we don't ever revisit the rates that we've had over the last 8 or 9 months. So the upside of that is that there are things you can take advantage of in agency CMBS. You have a segment of prepayments that are driven primarily by cash out refinances or property sales. These are the ones that are going to be curtailed. It's going to be curtailed because you're going to have, for two reasons, we're going to have stagnant and possibly falling multifamily property prices over the next few years. So this will have the heaviest impact in prime urban metro areas. Prices there have already started to decline. They've declined 8% year to date since the peak of the pre-pandemic, basically in late February, the very early part of March. So we've seen multifamily property prices fall about 8% so far right now. And it's important to understand that this has happened despite very low transaction volumes and so far no increase in the number of distressed sales. So voluntary prepayments that are coming from those cash out refis are going to be tamped down. Voluntary prepayments from interest rate driven refinances should also be very low over the next few years based on the higher rates. Both of the things for slower voluntary prepayments have impact sort of broadly on three different types of investments in agency MBS. The best performance you can get from these slow prepayments is a boost in performance from Ginnie Mae Project Loan IOs. IOs are kind of a funny sector for a lot of people, and I'm going to make a rough generalization about their behavior right now, is that generally speaking, they have the if you look at them across kind of all types of different CPR speeds, now the standard is to look at Ginnie Mae Project Loan IOs at 15 CPJ, which is 15 CPR and 100% of the Ginnie Mae Project Loan default curve. At 15 CPJ for the life of the loan, their projected performance is usually reasonable, but not fantastic in that it's, if you have either slower prepayment speeds below 15 CPR or faster prepayment speeds, obviously faster than 15 CPR over the life of the loan, they actually, the projected performance rises on either side, generally speaking, for kind of recent issue Ginnie Mae project loans. And the faster or slower those speeds deviate from what the average of 15 CPJ is, the higher those returns get. So right now we're looking at potentially a significant slowdown in prepayments, which boosts the projected performance of Ginnie Mae Project Loan IOs. So that's a good sector to look at for investors to look at. A sector that we've been warning investors to avoid or tread carefully in for the last year were those high premium dollar price agency CMBS that pay principal and interest. We've been have been warning people to avoid them, because when you have those really high premium dollar price and you get very fast prepayment speeds, you can underperform your expectations. Since we're actually going to go in the reverse, those look like good investments again, and those are a good place to overweight or at least not be scared of. So high premium dollar price P&I bonds look good as voluntary prepayments slow down. A third place to look is, you can get investors can get additional incremental yield by going into A1 tranches of Freddie K deals. These only prepay in the last 6 months of the deal, but that additional 6 months of slow prepayment can add a few basis points to 10 to 20 basis points of projected return if those prepayments are slow to zero. So those are all the good things that you can look forward to for slower voluntary prepayments. On the cautionary side, which is at least a lot more interesting but easy to define, is obviously involuntary prepayments that come from defaults are getting ready to accelerate next year and possibly for the next couple of years. The good news about the involuntary prepayments is the vast majority of that default risk is probably already identifiable because it's encompassed by the multifamily loans that are currently in forbearance in agency CMBS, and those can be identified. So these involuntary prepayments are going to accumulate as those multifamily properties transition from forbearance into default over the next year to 2 years. Good news is overall default and cumulative loss rates from these loans are probably going to be less than what was experienced during the housing crisis. The bad news from that is the loans that are in forbearance are transitioning at a relatively accelerated rate already into delinquency and into default. Because of the downdraft in multifamily housing prices and the long period of those loans being in forbearance, the loss severities on those loans are probably going to be more severe than what was typically has been historically seen. Loss severity rates on average have been 35 to 40% on agency CMBS, as they have been in a lot of other categories. It'd be a reasonable expectation that those loss severities are going to rise. For investors that want to identify that exposure, please reach out to your salesperson, reach out to me. We have printed absolutely exhaustive tables of on a deal-by-deal basis, on a tranche-by-tranche basis, of which loans in agency multifamily are in forbearance, what percentage of loans and deals are in forbearance across Freddie K deals, Ginnie Mae project loans, tranche-by-tranche in FRESB deals, and Fannie Mae DUS. So please reach out to us. On the FRESB side, again, they have the highest concentration of loans in forbearance. That segment in particular has been the hardest hit, and you have to go on a tranche-by-tranche basis in those FRESB deals to look at what tranches have loans that are in forbearance, where they are, because in one deal, some tranches can be completely unaffected, have no loans in forbearance, whereas other tranches might have 30 to 40 to 50% of the loans in that tranche in forbearance. So FRESB, Freddie Mac small balance loans, particular difficult point in the past year, going to be difficult coming up for those legacy deals. Seniors housing also have been overweight forbearances relative to the amount of outstanding loans kind of across the agency spectrum. Ginnie Mae construction loans in the construction loan segment of project loans, they're about 20% of outstanding Ginnie Mae project loans are construction loans, but their delinquency rates are about 2.5 times higher than those of regular standard project loans. So again, you have to watch for those higher concentrations, and we have tables that review deals that have higher concentrations of construction loans and construction loans that are currently in forbearance. Want to close with just kind of a broad spectrum look, which is something we continue to work on, and which I mentioned at the beginning, core urban areas of prime metros. That's where all the problems be. You could actually see a dichotomy in the market where multifamily properties in the suburbs and outside of core urban areas do absolutely fine and don't have any issue, whereas there's going to be a concentration risk in those areas. For Fannie Mae DUS investors, the fact that those pools are not diversified, that can be an excellent place to express that view of investing heavily in Fannie Mae DUS that are that are not in San Francisco, that are not in, you know, a concentrated metro New York area, that are not in, you know, the interior of Chicago. So that's a place where investors, again, can take advantage of the structure of DUS. And I am going to stop there, and I will pass it back to Steve, and I hope people submit questions.
All right. Thanks very much, Mary Beth. So I want to remind everybody that, as I noted at the beginning, there is a chat box on the right side of your webinar screen, and you can type questions in there. We've already started getting some questions that are rolling in. So I'm going to start with a question for Brian Landy. Brian, a listener is asking about your analysis of the spread between, you know, borrowers' note rates and the survey rate, the pool WAC and the survey rate. And the question is, do you mean to say that pre-COVID, the survey rate underestimated the rates borrowers were getting, and now it's overestimating? What's your spin on that?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily necessary even to say whether it was understating before or overstating now. I think it's more about the stability of the relationship. I mean, I guess in a sense you'd say yes, the average rate, you know, before COVID was higher than the survey rate, but the survey is also, you know, presumably targeted towards a particular type of borrower. So I think that what really matters more is that the relationship is stable, because if you're calibrating your, you know, models and your views about what rates borrowers are getting and, you know, what the effect is, you know, how that then relates to prepayment speeds, you just want whatever signal you're using, if that's the survey rate, to have a stable relationship with what borrowers are actually receiving. And you need to use something like a survey rate, because you don't get the information on what was actually originated, you know, for a couple of months, because there's a lag between, you know, the locked closing, the pooling. So you have to use something that's more current, more timely, and only sort of after the fact can you look back and say that, you know, whether or not that relationship held. And so I think what's really important is that the relationship was stable for a long, long time and then has deviated this year. And whether or not it was that the survey rate, say, suddenly adjusted to give a better view of what primary-secondary spreads were and was long before, or if it was right before and now it's wrong, kind of doesn't really matter. I think it's just that that's different, and that just tells you that you know, if you went back and just really looked at like a primary-secondary spread based off of what was actually originated, I think you'd have a very different view of what that baseline was and where we're at today and kind of how close to that baseline things really are.
Got it. Okay, so here I've got a question coming in. Again, we appreciate the questions. A question from a client focused on the agency CMBS market. So to Mary Beth, investors can get more spread in Freddie KA1 from slower voluntary prepayments, as you were pointing out, but then they're more exposed to involuntary prepayments. Is it worth the risk, or are these offsetting?
I actually think it is worth the risk because you can identify where you're going to get the involuntary prepayments from. And I would actually say when, as of the end of the last housing crisis, when that sort of resolved, involuntary prepayments in agency CMBS have been exceptionally low, if not downright rare in a lot of cases. And particularly in Freddie K's, they've been, I'm going to be all mathy on you, and I apologize for the expression, within epsilon of non-existent. So it's, for those, if you look at the deals that already have large amounts of forbearance, which in Freddie K's is not that many, and I can contact your salesperson or shoot me an email, send you the entire deal list of what which ones of those deals across the board have any loans in forbearance. And if you just avoid, you know, something that might have 14% of loans in forbearance, because that, yes, that can absolutely affect A1, I think you're going to be fine. It's the slowdown in voluntary prepayment should more than offset, in most cases, the acceleration in involuntary prepays.
Got it.
And you can identify the risk.
Okay, and now, so we're now getting a question that, or I have a feeling a couple of people on the line will have views. I guess I'm going to take the liberty of the moderator's spot to start the discussion, but the question really is about privatizing Fannie and Freddie and whether the two GSEs could be privatized before the next administration comes into office, and then what the effect would be on the mortgage market. So let me just offer some quick thoughts there, and then I'd invite my colleagues in. I think the short answer is FHFA has laid out what they believe are the proper capital requirements for Fannie and Freddie before they could be released into the private market. I don't think it's entirely clear exactly what the nature of their activities might be if they were to be released. Presumably, it would be to do exactly what they're doing now, but they would require substantial amounts of capital, far more than they obviously have today, and based on relatively simple math, it would take quite a long time for them to aggregate that amount of capital. The workaround would be to release them with a consent decree that would only allow them to go private once they had met presumably capital requirements and presumably had met other standards and stayed inside other guardrails, which would probably complicate the ability of the next administration to reverse course. I don't think it would be impossible. Obviously, these are agreements between the Treasury, FHFA, and the GSEs, and any administration has significant control at one point or another on all three parties, and that could be the ingredients for lots and lots of change, even, you know, down the road. But a consent agreement would create some friction, although I don't think, to me at least, it would make a material change. As far as the impact on the mortgage market goes, I think that any significant effort to put Fannie and Freddie back in a position similar to where they were before the 2008 crisis would raise some concerns in some important parts of the mortgage investor base about the ultimate backing of the GSE securities of all types, whether it's residential pass-throughs, CMBS, the debt, et cetera. So I think the impact on the mortgage market could be pretty significant, and ultimately that would create significant political obstacles to privatization, because the mortgage market affects voters in every single district across the country. But that's my two cents on it. My colleagues may have other views. So, or
I was going to let Chris answer first.
Either way, you want to go first, Mary Beth?
No, you go ahead.
I mean, I think Steve kind of hits on most of the salient points here. And, you know, I think given the fact that, you know, both Secretary Mnuchin and Director Calabria have had, you know, basically the entirety of the Trump administration to work on spinning the GSEs out of conservatorship, the kind of this, you know, last minute attempt to potentially spin them out via consensus decree, coupled with Secretary Mnuchin's comments last week that, you know, he wouldn't want to see the enterprises spun out until considerable capital has been built up, either via an equity raise or retained earnings. You know, I think it's, there's certainly concerns about trying to spin the enterprises out in a hurried fashion, given kind of the fragile ecosystem that is the, you know, mortgage finance market. But obviously there's, you know, a whole bunch of moving parts. Mary Beth will probably speak to the upcoming SCOTUS hearing about constitutionality of the FHFA and the implications for removing Director Calabria. So I think at that juncture, I may transition it, segue it to Mary Beth and let her take it from here.
Thanks, Chris. And yes, that's exactly what I was going to speak about very briefly. Also agree with everything that Steve and Chris just said. So tomorrow are oral arguments in the Collins v. Mnuchin case, which is going to be whether or not Calabria, the director of the FHFA, is deemed unconstitutional, who currently happens to be Calabria. And if so, whether or not the previous decisions of the director need to be set aside. Those are two different rulings. The first one the directorship would have to be found unconstitutional first before they could set aside anything. So oral arguments are tomorrow. They last an hour. I'm going to listen to them for fun. You really can't usually tell anything from oral arguments, but I will recap anything that comes out as interesting. The decision will probably take several months. Whoever's in the majority, if Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, is in the majority of the decision, he will assign who writes the majority opinion. If he's not in the majority, obviously, like every other case, the highest-ranking member in the majority will decide who writes the opinion. That will take – it's possible, like, if the decision were surprisingly 9-0, it could happen fairly quickly, but it really – the earliest it would be expected to be decided would be about March, possibly even as late as April. If it's deemed that the FHFA directorship is unconstitutional, at that point, almost any time after the decision, the Biden administration could ask Calabria to step down and begin the replacement process. kind of the secondary question, which would be, it's possible, but it would be very unusual for the Supreme Court to go this far, would be if they said yes, and other decisions need to be set aside that the director made. Importantly, this has nothing to do actually directly with the privatization, because what the shareholders were fighting when this case originally came out was the Third Amendment, which was the net worth sweep involved when the shareholders were litigating against. So what they are talking about is, would the net worth sweep be set aside? And I want to be brief because I know we have some other questions, so I'm just going to stop there. Please reach out to me if you want to discuss this, and I'll try to send out some notes tomorrow after they do oral arguments. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Thanks, Mary Beth. We probably have time for really one more question, and this one looks like it should go to Brian Landy. There was obviously a lot of discussion last year and continuing about forbearance. But I guess the question essentially is suggesting that on the conventional side, it didn't seem really to be a significant issue. Maybe more so on the Ginnie Mae side, are there any repercussions in the year to come for forbearance?
I think on the conventional side, it's the GSEs have much more control over, really it comes down to the buyout process, right? And so, or they put in place their payment deferral program. I mean, I guess really the question will be, how successful is that? I mean, I think my expectation is that most borrowers will, that go pretty deeply delinquent, as long as the economy is in a reasonable place, most borrowers will qualify for payment deferral, and, the prepayment effect will basically be nothing, right? Because they'll be able to stay in the pool, get their payment deferral, and continue on, kind of call it as if nothing happened. On the Ginnie Mae side, obviously their buyouts are not under Ginnie Mae's control. And I think luckily, other than the big bank buyouts over the summer, kind of month by month have gone by, and there hasn't been a big pickup in buyouts. You know, a few non-banks are buying out some more loans than others, but I mean, even so, it's still nothing compared to what the few banks did back in June, July, and following. So I think that's probably still where more of the concern is. If the loans stay in pools, at some point there's most loans entered forbearance really in March and April, and so kind of you head into the early part of next year. I mean, one way or the other, this has to be resolved. So I think that's kind of the end date for really a lot of it. I know there's been a little bit of a pickup in new forbearance right now, but I think it's still and maybe some reentrances as well, but I think it's still nothing. I mean, it's just nowhere close to what happened back in March and April. So I don't know if that answers the question.
I think it gets us heading in the right direction. So Brian, thank you. Appreciate that. So in keeping an eye on the clock, I think we basically just about run out our appointed hour. We greatly appreciate your sparing us the time, tuning in, helping us look over the horizon into 2021. There's lots of change, lots of risk and opportunity ahead. We hope you're going to continue following the markets through the work we do here at Amherst Pierpont in strategy, and through the good ideas of our colleagues as well. So thanks again. This really wraps up Outlook 2021 in MBS and securitized products. Have a great day and good luck in the markets.